what we're doing now, we are getting to a feel of the world that is neither organic nor mechanical. Simply, what it is. We don't know the contrast, just as we don't know the contrast voluntary, involuntary, we don't know the contrast organic.
All right, folks, we're back. Veterans Unplugged. This is the second week in a row. Meditations and Molotovs. I am your host, Vince Emanuele. And here we are, another Monday. What is it? July 11th here? July 11th. You can find us here every Monday at 1 o'clock Chicago time, 2 o'clock on the East Coast. So yeah, what are we going to talk about today? It's interesting. I've gotten a lot of feedback from the program. Some of it good, some of it negative. I find a lot of it interesting. I mean, there's a lot to explain to folks. It's like, what do you want me to explain? There's a lot of people expect a lot of different things. I mean, it would be a lot easier. Let me put it this way. First of all, I'm not in a studio. I mean, maybe I shouldn't be saying this. Maybe the producers or so on wouldn't be happy, or maybe they don't care. I don't know, but I basically, you know, it's almost like I would like people to kind of understand what the context is here. Okay. So first of all, it's very weird to hear your voice on headphones. Anyone who's ever done radio programs in the past, or anyone who has... I'm assuming it's very similar if you are, say, in a band or something like this. It's very weird to hear your voice. So, in other words, there's a lot of different ways I've tried to approach doing radio programs. I actually think some of this is interesting, so I hope that people will stay with me. I think people will stay with me because they generally know how I write and how I think and talk about things. It's, we're kind of bouncing all over. But, look, it's difficult. you hear your own voice, you're listening to the cadence, you're trying to come up with a good cadence. All kinds of things are influencing this. So previous podcasts I've listened to in the past are influencing this. Radio programs that I will occasionally tune into in my car will influence the way that I approach doing the radio show. It's a lot easier when you're sitting in a studio with someone. It's a lot easier to have a good conversation with them. So, for instance, one of the best interviews I've conducted in recent years was an interview I was able to conduct with Christian Parenti. And this was outside of a studio. There was no cameras on. There was no, you know, recording. Well, the only recording device was my audio recording device that was set in the middle of the table, very sort of innocuous. And, you know, not really in anyone's way or anything like that. And that was actually the best interview I've had in some time. Why? Well, because Christian and I were able to sit down like two friends would, or two family members or whatever, for basically 2 hours, 2.5 hours. You know, he had a cup of coffee. I drank a bottle of water. We sat in comfortable chairs. We were sitting across from each other as you would someone you went out to the bar with to have a drink, or someone you were going out to lunch with or whatever. It made the interview, in my opinion, one of the better interviews I've done, probably of all time. And that had little to do with where Christian was that day or what I was doing that day. It had a lot to do with just the set and the setting of where we were. So it's the same right now as I sit at home with noise-canceling headphones on and this wonderful microphone, and I'm looking at a computer screen, and I'm looking at my dry erase board, and I can pull up all kinds of things online, and you know, I could pull up old material, I can write on my board if I want to, and there's no one here with me, though. I mean, the only living creature that's within 100 feet of me is my cat, you know, who's wandering around the kitchen, probably wondering where his food is, since his food bowl, I can see, is somewhat empty. You know, that's kind of what's going on here. You know, so I got feedback from a friend of mine whose mother tuned into the program. And she was like, she told him, oh, my God, he sounds crazy. He sounds like Rush Limbaugh. And I'm laughing because it's interesting for people who have never conducted a radio program, it's very difficult. It is very difficult to hear your voice. I mean, some people like hearing their own voice, so it's not a problem for them. Now, I'm assuming when I listen to Rush Limbaugh's program for 3 hours at a time, I mean, you get into a certain zone. I don't think people understand it. I mean, you get into this very specific zone. I remember when I was in Australia last year doing a speaking tour around a documentary film called We Are Many. And I remember being on this tour for like 2 months, basically. Every 2 or 3 days, I had to give a speaking scheduled to give a speaking engagement. I can't speak today, nonetheless. And some days it was more than one in one day. And you get into a certain zone. You reply to people in a very specific way. You interact with people in a very specific way. Like, you can't be the normal person that you are because it's not a normal setting. It is not a normal setting for a human being to be put into a room with 300 or 400 people. Maybe say sometimes 30 or 40 people. Let's just say 30 or 40. So, which is more often than not. So 30 or 40 people, 50 people show up to listen to you speak. That's a decent crowd. Sometimes you get lucky. There's hundreds of people who show up. And then sometimes you get, well, depends who you are. I would say very lucky if you get to speak to thousands. But I've had an opportunity to speak to tens of thousands. I think one rally, well over 100,000 people. And in that space, it is very difficult to speak with people. You know, you're standing in front of tens of thousands of people. There's an echo with the microphone. So you can only say maybe 4 to 5 words, maybe up to 10 words, and then you have to stop. Really, maybe more like 4 or 5. So you would say 4 or 5 words, let the audience react, let the speakers catch up in the back of the space or the venue, and then you can speak again. It's equally as tough when you're interviewing people on the phone. You know, this has been difficult to speak with people about the most interesting and important topics of our time that you've never met before. So the interaction between, say, Liza Featherstone and I on the program is much different than, say, the interaction between Thomas Frank and I. Thomas Frank and I have been in the same room together. We've had dinner together. We've talked about things. We've gotten into disagreements. We've, you know, complimented each other. We've supported each other. Now, that's a big difference. You can have a much more substantial conversation, in my opinion, with someone who you have that sort of relationship with. I don't think that's, I don't think that that's that controversial at all. So, anyway, the point is, it's difficult to speak on the radio. Now, I can do it very naturally. Now, I could do as I've been trying to do with the program now, I've gotten feedback from some folks who say, hey, I actually really enjoy the cadence. I enjoy the pauses that you take. I enjoy the way that you're doing this. It sounds very professional. It sounds very good. To be honest with you, folks, when I'm listening to the radio, I mean, the people on NPR to me sound ridiculous. I mean, those people sound completely ridiculous. The people on NPR, not the content, the manner in which they're speaking, the tone, and so forth, the pace, the cadence, the volume, the fashion in which they try and deliver their message. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's really ridiculous. I mean, honestly, when I tune in to AM radio, what I hear from Rush Limbaugh or what I hear from Michael Savage sounds a lot more like the way, you know, like the Americans that I know or the people that I know who speak to each other on a daily basis about these issues. That sounds more like that. You know, Limbaugh's program sounds more akin to what I'm used to hearing, living in a working class, blue collar, Rust Belt city and region, as opposed to when I listen to NPR. It sounds absurd. all of it, that's, and so all of this is to say that part of what you do with a medium like this is a performance. So part of this is like a performance. I don't think people understand that sometimes. I mean, it's the same with writing. And people are so goddamn critical. It's amazing. it's truly amazing to me just how critical people can be. I mean, if you don't like what someone has to say, it's not a big deal. It's not a big deal. So you listen to some of it and say, hey, you know, this particular article, this particular segment, I don't really enjoy it. So I like something else that the person does. It's not a big deal. I mean, these days I hear from so many people, oh, I don't like this article, or I didn't like what this person had to say here, so I'm done with this person. You know, like, oh, I'm not going to listen to this anymore. Like this, I feel like we have become so inclined to do that as a culture and a society. Like, we are more than inclined to just throw the baby out with the bathwater every time. I mean, if we don't like one thing that someone says, see you later. I find that unfortunate. There's plenty of stuff out there that I like that, you know, and people who put out messages, some of which I agree with and some of which I don't agree with. I don't think it's a big deal. But I get these messages from people who say, oh, Vince, you took position X, Y, or Z. I can no longer trust you. You're a sellout. I can no longer follow you. I no longer care what you have to say about anything. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, that to me is just ridiculous. So anyway, we can move on. I just wanted to kind of mention some of these things. I've been getting a good amount of feedback now. Like, people are having it easy, finding it easy to acquire my email address, which is cool because I put it at the end of a lot of the essays that I do and so on. So people can get a hold of me. So I can hear, you know, what people have to say and what they think about various issues and if they enjoy what I'm saying, if they don't enjoy what I'm saying. I think a lot of this stuff is, for me, a lot of the responses I get from people are useful as well. Very useful. Some of them aren't useful. But, you know, I get the point I'm trying to make is that it's very difficult. It's very difficult to get across what people want. Now, you know, talking with people regularly, whatever that means, it's a lot easier. I'll try and sound more like that. That's fine. I mean, but I can only do, see, I could do different, we could do different styles here. That's another thing. It doesn't have to be one way. People expect a lot of different things, so I don't know. And I don't want to turn off too many people if we're trying to keep people interested and, you know, educate people. And that's another thing. The audience is much different. There's people listening to this program who don't know what neoliberalism is. There's people who are listening to this program who can write books or have written books on neoliberalism. That is a wide range, people. That's another thing I have to contend with. I get emails from people who are like, what in the hell are you even talking about? And then I get emails from people who are saying, then stop telling me things that I already know. Yeah. Yeah, I can only do so much here. You know, I mean, we really are trying to get out to as many people as possible. Like, I want as many people as humanly possible to check out the program. For me, that's what it's all about. It's not about, like, you know, I want this small little segment of society to listen to me. I don't want to be in a leftist bubble, which is another thing I've been thinking about in light of everything that's happened in the past week. So we've used a robot, a police force, the Dallas police force, used a robot to kill the person. I don't have his name pulled up. I don't really care about these people, to be honest with you. I think the less we use their names, the better. I've seen some media outlets doing that as well. Like, the less attention you give these people, the better off we'll be as a society, and I'm a firm believer in that. Because I think people have ridiculous egos. We all have egos. We all have egos, and we all like for people to talk about us. This is what part of why we like social media, part of why we like getting likes from people and messages and people showing you love. And people like this. Now, on some level, it's healthy. You want love and affection, people to show you those things. On another level, it can be very unhealthy. I don't even know where the hell I was going with that. But nonetheless, the point is, oh, yes, the shooter in Dallas. Let's not even, I don't even care what his or her name is. Well, his, that's another thing. As we mentioned a couple of programs ago, 95% plus of the people who commit these acts are men. That might just be something we want to talk about. Now, is that the only factor at play? Of course not. Of course not. This person was also a veteran. And amazing. Is that amazing to anyone? Is that surprising to anyone? Hey, let me tell you something. If I didn't find something productive to do with my anger, if I didn't find a way to challenge that anger in what had at times has been unproductive ways, but largely productive ways, if I hadn't found that over the last 10 years, if I didn't find passions and things that I cared about, if I didn't try and create things, I could imagine doing crazy things too. I don't think it's that out there. Now, maybe I'm callous. Maybe I'm cynical. Maybe I'm conditioned to these things. But, I mean, is anybody really surprised that this person was a veteran? Particularly a veteran who had come home, became politicized, and understood that they were sent to a bullshit war to kill innocent people for no good reason. Well, for plenty of good reasons if you're rich and powerful. But for the rest of us, for no good reason. I mean, that's, you know, that's it. We have a male veteran. And then the people who are cheering the shooting of the police, I mean, I don't even know. Here's the deal. I mean, I think some people, especially in this country, people have a death wish. There's no doubt about this. I mean, this goes all the way back to Freud, civilization and its discontent, talking about this death wish. And I've in the past heard Derek Jensen and other people talk about Western culture, Western civilization in that way. And it's funny because we're a society that it sort of feeds on death. You know, so you're filling your car with death, dinosaur bones, you know, and not to mention the blood and material of people all over the world. But that's nonetheless, the point is, for a culture that is constantly violent, we don't like to talk about death. And, you know, speaking of death, it's funny now that the conversation is about how police officers don't want to put their lives in danger. Oh, my God, there was a shooter and we had to use a robot to kill him. I hope the people who are listening to this who haven't had a chance to maybe research the story as much as they have really understand what just happened. We had an unmanned robot take the life of a human being here in the United States. Now, this has happened before, largely in Iraq and Afghanistan, and also other places overseas. And maybe we should get into some of the history of that. So let me, I want to pull up, this is part of a talk that I was giving a couple of years ago. Again, this isn't to toot my own horn, but I will say I'm very, very, very happy I've been ahead of the curve, especially on this issue. It's something that I do take a little bit of pride in. Because I think it's one of the most important issues of our time, and we are not talking about it in a serious manner. And for those who would argue, well, there's nothing much we can do about it, that may be true in the short term, but in the long term, we are going to have to decide how these technologies are used and why. So with regard to drones and technology and militarism, you know, according to P.W. Singer, who is a senior fellow and director of the Center for 21st Century Security and Intelligence at the Brookings Institution. This is sort of the future of weapons technology. Okay, so the first Predator drones were used in 1995 during the Balkan conflicts in Bosnia and Kosovo. By 2000, the Air Force was developing ways to weaponize the Predator drones as they had previously been used exclusively in spy missions. So that's something to keep in mind immediately. Technology that was sold to people as just being used in non-lethal ways, of course, becomes weaponized and is indeed used in the coming years in a very lethal fashion. So when we started the war in Iraq, the United States started the war in Iraq, a handful of drones were operating in Iraqi airspace. By 2010, there were 5,300 drones operating in Iraqi airspace. 5,300. Additionally, we went into Iraq with zero unmanned ground systems. So these are drones that operate on the ground. The United States by 2010 was using over 12,000 ground drone operating systems in Iraq. In the future, well, at least according to many military personnel, you know, we should expect probably tens of thousands of robots to be operating in battle zones around the world. So if Moore's law holds true, those same robots 25 years from now will be close to a billion times more powerful in their computing power than today. And for those who are interested, Moore's law is the observation that over the history of computing hardware, the number of transistors on integrated circuits doubles approximately every 2 years. So most of this has gone utterly unnoticed in some ways. Of course, there are people who are speaking about drones, but it's very limited and it is in very limited circles. But we're currently living in, as Peter Singer reminds us, a very revolutionary period. So in terms of redefining what modern warfare is and how it relates to our existence and our future, much like the atomic bomb. So this is possibly even more important. So as Singer mentions, quote, "This revolution is more important than the atomic bomb, as it affects not only the how of war fighting, but the who of fighting wars. In other words, what does it mean when human beings no longer fight wars?" Sure, right now the U.S. is currently ahead in robotics technology, but that will change as with most other forms of technology. Currently, there are 24 other nations around the world working on robotics technology and unmanned drones. 24 other nations. So let's stop there and let's think for a moment, okay, about what it looks like, because this day will come. Say in a couple decades, when the majority of the countries around the world are able to operate unmanned drones, whether they be on the ground or whether they be in the air. What does that look like? Of who's going to govern? Because even right now, there are major questions. You know, so what does this mean for international law? Huge questions. Huge challenges for international legal scholars and for international judicial bodies. That's not to say, of course, the ethics and the morality of what's happening, and how can these developments lend themselves to various forms of war crimes? And if these war, and if indeed there are war crimes being committed, who's responsible? Those are the sort of questions we have to answer now. I would argue the reason we're not having those conversations is because it's going to implicate all of the wrong people. People like the President of the United States. High military ranking officials around the world and governmental officials and so on. But particularly in the United States, where we have used these drones, and particularly under the Obama administration. So this is the major point of departure, as Singer points out. You know, many Americans will be more inclined to go to war if they view these conflicts as costless. And in light of what happened in Dallas, I would argue that many Americans will be more inclined to conduct militaristic operations domestically if they view these militaristic operations as costless, particularly in police lives. So to put differently, if there isn't a risk of police officers losing their lives, say serving a warrant, so on, I think more and more Americans would be inclined to let them serve more warrants, to bust down more doors, to patrol more areas. So now, you know, we're watching war in real time via YouTube, TV, various other mediums. Yet, as Singer points out, we're experiencing much less of those wars. The public isn't being asked to sacrifice, nor are they being asked to sacrifice the lives of their loved ones. So here's how one soldier explained his experience as a drone pilot. Quote, "You're going to war for 12 hours, shooting weapons at targets, directing kills on enemy combatants, and then you get in the car and you drive home. Within 20 minutes, you're sitting at your dinner table talking about homework with your kids. In fact, drone pilots have higher rates of suicide and PTSD than soldiers on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan." So within 20 minutes, these people are going from, say, conducting in Dallas, let's remember, this was sort of a suicide bomber. That was how the drone was used. So there was a explosive. I still haven't read about any of the details. I'm sorry, I haven't encountered any of the details in anything that I've read so far, i.e. what kind of explosive, etc. Regardless, the Dallas police strapped a bomb to a drone robot, drove it into the area where the shooter was, and blew up the robot. Now, on the surface, that should be pretty frightening for people. If it's not frightening, again, I would reference the early part of this conversation in the early part of this program where we're talking about what the implications are. And really, I don't know how to rationally explain that to somebody. Like, if you think it's okay for a robot to be killing people, then this is good. This is another fundamental schism in our society. And I can see this growing. This is just, as so many of these things are, the tip of the iceberg. In some ways, I wish I was just being born today in 2016 so I can truly see what the rest of this century is going to be like. Because at 32 years old in 2016, I think I'm pretty young. I think I'm going to see what the end game is for a lot of these technologies and the climate and the economy and what humanity can take and what these antiquated institutions can withstand. But I oftentimes wish I was younger. So I'd really like to see where this is going. And the technology, I think, robotics technology, artificial intelligence, biotechnology, nanotechnology, this is one of the most important fronts for the future. And one of the fundamental questions we're going to have to ask is whether or not those robots, number one, should have the capability to take people's lives. But number two, with the development of autonomous weaponized robotic systems, which are currently being developed at a pace that would dictate that half of the Army's forces will be unmanned by 2025. That's half by 2025. That's according to the Brookings Institute. We are moving into a very different era, ladies and gentlemen. This, to me, is one of the most important aspects of what happened in Dallas over the last week. There is so much more to talk about, undoubtedly. Race, class, corrupt institutions, policing, white supremacy, patriarchy. How all of these overlying and intersecting forms of oppression and institutions and governmental and corporate entities interact with each other. It's a very, very serious conversation, undoubtedly. And people are having it, and they will be having it. And they'll continue to have it. But I put out on Facebook not too long ago, that was a day after the shootings, that, you know, that was the biggest surprise, precedent, the most unfortunate, the most dangerous precedent set in my thinking probably in decades. Before the Dallas police blew up a robot and hence a suspect, there had never been an unmanned robot used to kill an American citizen domestically. Now, we know U.S. citizens have been executed abroad. And honestly, the fact that it's a U.S. citizen doesn't really add or subtract anything for me. It's just, it's killed human beings, okay? This goofy argument is used. See, these are the kind of arguments, this is going to go off subject, but I hope you're staying with me. These are the kind of arguments that drive me mad. When people say these kinds of things, like, and a lot of leftists are guilty of this too, where, they, you know, people are saying, oh, a U.S. citizen was killed by drone strikes abroad. Well, to me, they're like, oh, legally that matters. Oh, no, legally that matters. No, to me it doesn't. If you're using the technologies to kill people abroad, then you had bet your ass that eventually those technologies are going to be used to kill an American. And you can bet your ass that whatever technologies are used abroad are going to come back home. I reference, or would reference, Alfred McCoy's book. Or, I'm sorry, not even his book, his work. Documenting the counterinsurgency strategies that go all the way back to the Spanish-American War and in the Philippines in the late 1800s, all the way to Vietnam and Korea and Vietnam, all the way to Iraq and Afghanistan. Sort of the same counterinsurgency ideologies, the same methods, the same technologies, the same tactics, although refined in very brutal and sadistic ways, have been transferred throughout time. And the technologies and the techniques that we've used abroad always come back home. People in Chicago understand this because of, what's his name? John Burge? I think it's John Burge. Nonetheless, the police official who was recently put in jail, recently released from jail, it's sickening. He only did 4 years for torturing people. He had been torturing people on the south side of Chicago for years using the techniques that he learned in Vietnam. So here's a corrupt, racist, power-hungry, violent police officer who already shouldn't be on the streets, using technologies and methods, including shocking people's genitals with car batteries, because, of course, this is what happened in Vietnam. This is what people learned. So using those tactics at home as a police officer on the south side of Chicago, largely to young black males. And then falsely imprisoning them, falsely convicting them, falsely, you know, planting evidence and so on. And here we have the same thing. So how wild is this? We have, I wasn't even planning on taking it this angle, but I'm thinking of all the connections with veterans and militarism. So here you go. Here's the connections. You have a veteran who comes home from Afghanistan, PTSD, no doubt, alienated, isolated, becoming politicized, upset that he was sent to another BS war, upset that he had to do probably terrible things overseas, most likely thinking about killing himself, most likely has homicidal thoughts, comes back to a society that largely doesn't give a shit, who then takes it upon himself to kill a bunch of police officers who are also, guess what? Disproportionately veterans, of course, because what do veterans do when they get home? They join police departments. This isn't out of the ordinary either. A veteran, an upset veteran with PTSD, killing veterans who likely have PTSD and problems of their own, who are patrolling a protest because police officers keep killing unarmed, and even if they're armed or whatever, young black men, largely. And they're killing all kinds of people, but disproportionately young black men. So this is the context here. And then you use technologies that both the shooter and the police officers who were killed by the shooter encountered and or used when they were overseas serving in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I shouldn't say serving, occupying either Iraq or Afghanistan. So veterans killing other veterans, and then the police officers who are veterans using technology that both the veteran shooter and the veterans on the police force used in Iraq and Afghanistan to kill the shooter by a suicide bomb. You're telling me that's not crazy? If you're telling me that this place isn't a war zone, or if you're telling me that I'm not getting the same scenes as what I would get if I lived in Turkey or Syria or Lebanon or Palestine or Iraq or Afghanistan or Pakistan or Egypt or Libya, and although it is not as pronounced in the United States, largely because we don't have a superpower occupying and dismantling our government and destroying our country and our infrastructure. But nonetheless, this place is a war zone. I mean, folks, everybody needs to get serious. This is no joke, you know. I mean, you have to laugh about certain things. You have to. I mean, if we don't laugh about some of this, people don't come out with jokes and comedies and sketches and so on. I mean, we will all drive each other crazy. So let's, please, people should laugh. People should joke. People should cynically mock some of these things. It should happen. It should. It's only natural. The way that human beings deal with tragedy. With tragedy comes comedy. This has been the way in Western, this has been the way it goes in Western culture and Western society for thousands of years. The great Greek tragedies are also comedies. This is the same now. No different. We have to laugh. But it's also very scary, you know, so we have to strike the correct balance. sometimes we have to laugh about these things, and other times we have to take them dead seriously. I think we could do both at the same time. For the first several days after the shooting, I can understand why, you know, some people felt the need to set up memorials and so on. And, you know, that brings me to another thing. It was interesting. Something that I saw pretty regularly on social media and even essays and so on that were written in the aftermath of the shootings in Dallas. Sort of this inclination to subjectivize everything. It's really interesting. So a lot of people were like, hey, we just need to be nice to each other. Or we need to just be more polite. We need to understand each other more often. I understand the intention, and I don't think anyone can argue that that's a bad intention. I mean, if you were, I'd say that's probably a bit too cynical even for me. So, as we used to say in the military, good intentions, bad judgment. So why is the judgment flawed? Because it's simply being nice to each other isn't going to change centuries of systemically and inherently oppressive and repressive institutions, cultural mechanisms, social mores, and so on. Simply being nice to each other doesn't change these things. Saying that people, in a time like this, saying to people, we just need to be nice to each other is as silly as telling people in 2008, you just need to be nice to people. No. After the 2008 financial collapse, it wasn't that people needed to be nice to each other. It wasn't that people needed to be more mindful of their checkbook. It was that we had a systemically bad system in place that the economic institutions of our time, as they continue to be in their current forms, are inherently unequal and inherently produce inequalities and catastrophes. And that this will continue to happen on a regular basis until something drastically ruptures the status quo. That's the way that this economy works. It doesn't matter people being nice to each other, if people only saved a little bit more, if people didn't leave beyond their means. It had nothing to do with any of that. It's the same now. We're talking about systemic racism. We're talking about systemic violence in this society. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about institutions that produce racism and racist cultures, and racist cultures that feed on those inherently racist institutions. One of my friends recently got a hold of me, and he was like, hey, Vince, you know, there's people who are pulling the trigger. That's what he kept telling me. There's people who are pulling the trigger. Well, you are right. There are individuals who are pulling the trigger, but let's not focus on those individuals. If you think those individuals need to be punished, that's fine. If you think those individuals who did something completely despicable and were caught on camera or convicted and so on, and yes, of course those people should be held accountable. But let's not get it twisted, folks. You can send as many police officers as you want to jail, and this goes all the way to the Chilcot report in the UK about the war in Iraq and Tony Blair and George Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and Condi Rice and the whole crew. Sure, send them all to jail. That is fine with me. Would that, in my thinking, maybe, just maybe, prevent future presidents from doing more outlandish things? Sure, it would, I think, in the short term, until they came up with a way to justify what it was they wanted to get done. I mean, so if we put – let's put it this way. Let's say we send Blair and Bush to jail tomorrow, W. Bush, and Cheney and who else. Say add a list of 25 people that people say are the architects and the people most responsible for the war in Iraq and for the devastation now that's been unleashed in that part of the world as a result of the occupation and invasion and destruction of Iraq. Let's say that that happens. Do people really think that there will no longer be wars? Do people think that the United States will no longer launch illegal occupations? Do people in the United States, I mean, what exactly is it that activists think they're going to get from that? Justice? Okay. Honestly, those people could be executed on live TV over and over again. And you, if you could execute them and bring them back to life and then execute them again, it wouldn't matter. It just wouldn't matter. Am I all for it? Send them to jail. That's fine. Put them in jail for the rest of their lives. Does that make up for, or is that what we consider justice? Because these people are responsible for the deaths of, most likely now we can safely say, millions of people, if not hundreds of thousands of people, innocent people. For me, no. Doesn't make much of a difference. It's the same with the police officers today. I mean, will it make people feel a little better? Sure. And is that good? Maybe. But don't argue with me that that's justice. Don't argue that that's going to make a significant difference. You could send all of these cops to jail. It ain't going to make a damn difference. You could send Bush and Blair and everyone else to jail, and it ain't going to make a damn difference, folks. Because there's still going to be political, economic institutions in place that require more and more warfare, more and more violence, more and more oppression, and so on. So it doesn't matter. Police will continue to kill black, young black, innocent men and others. Not because there's no recourse. Not because the recourse is lacking. But because we're still going to have police forces in their current structure, in their current form, that are going to behave the way that police forces have always behaved. So as many older activists and scholars have pointed out, and including the gentleman Serpico, the great movie with Al Pacino about the New York City police officer who eventually, you know, spoke out about the corruption within the police force. Him and many, many, many other people have pointed out, since really Mike Brown and Ferguson, when a lot of these protests started and when people really started to take note of police killings, police shootings, and specifically, say, the Black Lives Matter movement, many of the older activists and people have pointed out that none of this is new. In fact, some would argue it's probably better than it used to be. In fact, it is better than it used to be. It's just that now people are catching things on camera. But the things people are seeing on camera today, poor people, and particularly poor people of color, have known and have experienced and have seen these things for decades. None of that shit is new to them. None of it. It's just now people have cell phones, so you're starting to see some of this on camera, YouTube, social media, and so on. You're just starting to see it. But none of it is new. And even if you send every single one of those cops to jail in Baltimore, do you think the Baltimore City Police Department is going to be that much better? Of course it isn't. It's not going to be that much better because we have no control over it, because we don't have any power. And that's really what we're talking about here. Whether it be military technology, I was going to read you a little bit more about some of the specifics of what DARPA is creating. But we can get into that another time. And actually, I probably have a special program specifically about military technology. Probably have P.W. Singer on the program. And that's not Pete Singer, the animal rights activist and philosopher. This is a different Pete Singer, P.W. Singer, I'll call him. I'd like to have him on the program. In fact, I will have him on the program. And we'll talk about these issues. Very interesting. I don't really know what his politics are, and to be honest with you, I don't really care. What I know is that he's sort of at the forefront of investigating military technologies and unmanned autonomous robotic systems. That's what I'm interested in. So all of the information that he has with regard to those weapon systems is what I'm primarily interested in listening to and learning about from Pete W. Singer. So check out his work if you want to. Be enough about the unmanned robotic systems. But that, to me, is the most important thing that's come out of Dallas. I'm sorry, again, am I the least bit surprised that a veteran lost his mind and shot up a bunch of police officers or civilians or anyone else? No. I mean, that doesn't surprise me in the least bit. I was not surprised at all when I found out about the news. In fact, I took a few days away from the news because I felt like there was nothing I can do, and I read every comment and so forth that I could see on social media, and I was like, what am I going to add to the conversation? I don't think there's much to add. Everybody's saying everything that needs to be said. The only thing that immediately I thought was missing, and I've seen other outlets and other commentators and so on mention it now and talk about it a little more, is the fact that an unmanned robot was used to kill the shooter in Dallas, and not just to kill him, but to explode itself. So, like a suicide bomber that's a robot, which has all kinds of sick irony packed into it. Understanding that many of the police are veterans and that that robot had been used in Iraq and that the shooter himself was a veteran shooting other veterans, and those veterans using technologies that they used in Iraq to kill the shooter. That's where we're at. None of it surprised me, but the people who did, I mean, I had plenty of people reach out to me and go, Vince, what do you think? What do you think? And I mean, I'm sorry, I hate to sound like a broken record, but this is just the beginning, folks. This is just the beginning. As this economy continues to fail, and as Jack Rasmus continues to mention on his program, I think really document as well as any other economist, and especially as well as any economist who tries to get that information to regular people, there's another recession on the way. And when it hits, it's going to be bad. And when the economy gets shot into a full-blown recession, people are going to be hurting even more than they're hurting now. And right now, people are hurting so bad that two-thirds of the American electorate either wanted to vote for a fascist or a democratic socialist. Those things are only going to make those schisms, those contradictions, those inequalities, that alienation is only going to grow with time. This is the same here. I mean, let's pose the question in a different manner. Are relations between African Americans and police officers better today or worse than they were in August 2014 when Michael Brown was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri? Well, obviously I don't have to answer that question because it's a rhetorical question. We all know the answer. So unless something changes, drastically changes, what in the hell do people think it's going to be like 2 to 3 years from now? Do people really think that 2 or 3 years into a Clinton or a Trump administration that things are going to be hunky-dory? Or do people think that 2 or 3 years into a Trump or Clinton administration, this country, mark my words, and I promise this, and I bet my bottom dollar on it, will be more divided than at any time in recent history, and that includes 1968. The contours will be different. Yes, race will still play a primary role, so on. But the contours will be different than the 68 generation as they are now. Somewhat similar, some of the fundamentals remain, but the context, with all of this taking place within the context of runaway climate change and ecological collapse, adds such a significant element to what it is we're dealing with that previous generations hadn't had to deal with. So not only are we experiencing, in my opinion, the failure of centuries of institutions that are now completely antiquated. That includes modern policing. That includes modern prisons. That includes modern education system. That includes capitalist economy. That includes using fossil fuels. That includes industrialization and so on. So we have to find alternatives to these institutions, and quick. We have to. There's no other, we don't have an option. But I am, lately I have to admit, I've been less inclined to take a hopeful stance. And I don't know, maybe hope is the wrong word. there's a poem or a short sort of spoken word about hope that I'll maybe read at some point in one of the programs. I think it's really good. So maybe that's the wrong word. In fact, it is the wrong word. But we had better get serious about creating these communities and these cultures of resistance. There are people out there who are devoting their time to this. There's no doubt. I know them. I've spent a good amount of time around them for the last 10 years of my life. I've been one of those people for most of the last 10 years. And I can say, as someone who has devoted much of my spare time, much of my free time, that I have a hard time envisioning something positive in the future for us, unless people, and quickly, really pull their heads out of their asses and start devoting themselves to this kind of work. I have to. You have to speak out. You have to use your talents. And it can't be this, oh, we're going to help. You know, we're going to do some things in the community, and we're going to have like a food drive and a fundraiser, and we're going to collect winter clothes for homeless people in the winter. All of that is great. All that's great. And all that should be incorporated into radical politics. What I'm talking about is people envisioning different institutions and different visions for what they want to see, what kind of a society they would like to build in the future. What's an alternative economy to the capitalist economy? There are ideas out there, and they don't solely come from Karl Marx or the 1800s. There are new people out there thinking of new ideas. What are they? And how do we implement them? Until we get people on that page, not just like this, oh, you know, maybe we can get universal health care and this and that. Yeah, well, we need all that too. We need a Western European social democracy, whatever you want to call it, welfare state. Yeah, that needs to happen right now. Of course, we need that right now just for people to have a decent survival. But in the meantime, that doesn't solve any of these problems. That doesn't come up with an alternative to the modern policing that we experience. You know, it doesn't come up with an alternative to capitalism. It doesn't come up with an alternative to militarism or standing armies. We need to abolish all of those things. And I feel like we need to have that conversation. I almost feel like we're living in intellectual dark times. Or like people can't dream anymore. People can't think of alternatives. You talk to people about alternatives, and it's like you're talking to a rock. You know, people go, oh, well, I don't know. It's too tough. These institutions are too much. And I mean, can you imagine if this is how people thought back in the day when we were trying to move away from feudal systems or the divine right of kings and so on? Anyway, you're listening to Meditations and Molotovs. I am your host, Vince Emanuele. Come find us every Monday on the Progressive Radio Network.